In 91, you voted against the Persian Gulf War.
Yes.
And why did you?
Well, that's a very interesting story. We had three different intelligence groups. We had a Defense Intelligence Agency and the CIA and another intelligence agency. They did estimates of what would happen if we went into Kuwait and started the war there. I'll just give you an example. This is not a real number. Let's say the Iraqis, Saddam Hussein, had 10,000 tanks and we were only going to have 4,000. You'd think from that we were going to have a tough time of it. And so all the intelligence I was seeing was static intelligence. So many people here, so many people there, so many tanks here, some tanks there, this and that. President Bush Sr., who I developed a close friendship with, he was getting most of his intelligence from the other intelligence agency, Defense Intelligence. They had information that was very important. For example, our tanks could shoot 2,000 meters further than their tanks. So it didn't matter if they had twice as many tanks. If our tanks could shoot further, they'd just come up, sit there where their tanks couldn't hit ours. We could destroy all theirs. So he felt there would be far fewer casualties and that it would be far, far less difficult. So that was one of the things we later learned, only by talking to each other afterwards, that we were getting two different sets of intelligence briefings at the White House and in the Congress. So I just felt we would have less loss of life and so on than to just draw a ring around them, you know, not let them come out beyond Kuwait, but not try to go in and invade Kuwait. I'm not sure whether I was right or wrong. Once we later learned all these wrinkles of the intelligence, one part of the government was not talking to the other part.
Did the president talk to you about that after that vote?
Oh, yes. Yes, he did. President Bush Sr. and I, again, being friends, we had the closest relationship of friendship, really, that I had even with a Democratic president. But we probably had the stormiest relationship at the same time. Some of the times I just went down, and I think this is something that, oh, I wish it could happen again in this country. I hate to see all the partisanship. When President Bush sent a letter to Tariq Aziz, the foreign minister of Iraq, and said, you have to withdraw from Kuwait at a certain time, and who's waiting for an answer? He had decided if there was a negative answer, there was going to be war and invasion, and he was hoping there'd be an affirmative answer. General Scowcroft, the president's national security advisor, called me. He knew the president and I were close friends. He said, David, could you just come down to the White House? The president is walking up and down in his office just like a caged animal. He's so nervous. He's so stressed. I came down, and we had already had some preliminary discussions about whether he should go to war or not, and I'd said I didn't think so. I said, no, this isn't the time. One time, I bet there was 2 hours when I was just in the room with him, no one else but me, and we didn't exchange a word. It's just that I was there as a friend. I wasn't there as a senator. I was there as a friend at this difficult, terrible moment in his life. And so we had that kind of relationship.
But it's interesting that he wanted you there. He knew you were against the war.
He knew, but he wanted me there as his friend. It was totally a friendship thing. It was not anything to do with where we stood on this issue.
So what you say is you're humanizing the president.
Oh, very much so.
Yeah.
I had those kinds of relationships. I remember President Carter called me one time at 11 o'clock at night. Mrs. Carter was out of town, and there was something he was working on and worrying about. He just wanted to talk, not necessarily about politics or anything, just talk. And with President Reagan, even during the Iran-Contra affair, and there was worry about impeachment, Senator Howard Baker of Tennessee was a great friend of mine. I admired him very much. He was a very nonpartisan person. He was his temporary chief of staff. They had fired the chief of staff at the White House, and they'd brought Baker in as temporary chief of staff. He called me, and he said, the president is so depressed, and he's due to make a speech to the country, and I'm afraid he's going to be defiant and just say, impeach me, and it's going to go badly. So he said, would you talk to President Reagan? So I said, I'm going to sit down and write a letter to him, because he'd given up hope. He said, my presidency's over. He was considering resignation or defiance. Those were the two things. I'm either going to defy them or I'm going to resign.
And again, it's over Iran-Contra.
It was over Iran-Contra.
Right.
He was due to make a speech to the nation.
Yeah.
So I wrote him a letter and I said, I'm a Democrat. You're a Republican. You're the only president our country has. I'm an American first, and I want you to succeed for the good of the country. And you can do more. There's much you can accomplish in the rest of your term. You've had this problem, but there's much you can accomplish, especially in arms control. I said, the Russians are afraid. You can do in arms control what probably no one else can, because they're all afraid of him. Remember Star Wars and all these things? And I said, I will help you. I promise to help you. And the Intelligence Committee will be sure to help you with your arms control efforts. I'd had the letter I'd written, hand-delivered. Senator Baker hand-delivered it to the president. I went over to the White House the next day. Vice President Bush, then, we were in the cabinet room, Democrat-Republican leaders. And he said, the president wants to see you alone in the Oval Office after everyone leaves. I said, do you know about the letter? I was surprised. Vice President Bush said, he called several of us in and read the letter out loud to us. So he said, he wants to see you. And he said, it's really important to go and see him. So I went in, and President Reagan was standing there by himself in the Oval Office. He pulled out the letter, my letter, and he started to talk about it to me. He said, you'll never know how much this meant to me at the moment I got it. You forget these people are human beings. And he started to cry. He wept. And we were alone. There I was with the President of the United States, and he is weeping. I kind of made a gesture like, there, Mr. President, you know, it's going to be all right. It was kind of an awkward moment because it wasn't just tears in his eyes. He was weeping. He said, it convinced me that I can do some good things still, and I will. I'll cooperate. He gave them that speech in which he was cooperative and reached out his hand and said, I'll work together with Congress on reforming the system so that everybody has to be told what's going on and everything else. So that was a really moving moment. It's really interesting. I wrote that letter by longhand, and I thought I'd kept a Xerox copy because it wasn't typed. But I could never find it. After President Reagan died, we couldn't find it. So we called the Reagan Library, and a librarian there spent a week looking for it and finally called me one day, and she said, I found the letter. And he had written on it, we'll respond in person, you know, his initials. Now, in my papers at OU, there's a Xerox copy of the letter from the Reagan Library. You know, that's what I learned working with these people up close, presidents and various people like that. They all have very human feelings, you know. We just forget that. I think that's something that always has to be understood, and you always have to give the other person a little room to stand on.